Every family has its secrets, and when Vita's great-great-granddaughter, Helene, started to uncover hers, it led to discoveries about who she really is. Author Helene Stepinski joins us next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Helene Stepinski is the author of Five Finger Discount, A Crooked Family History, Baby Plays Around, A Love Affair with Music, and has written for the New York Times, New York Magazine, Salon, Travel and Leisure, and many other publications, including the Jersey Journal. She joins us today from her home in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, Helene.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get started first of all. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a writer. I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is right across the harbor from New York City. I went to New York University and then to Columbia for my MFA. And since then, I've pretty much been writing books. This is my third book, but I freelance also full-time. And I write for mostly the New York Times, but also for magazines and all different kinds of people. I've had many other lives as well. I was a drummer in a rock band, which is what the second book is about, on the Lower East Side. I also lived in Alaska. I was a radio DJ up there and a news director in Nome, up near Siberia. So I've lived about seven lives at this point. I've still got a couple left.
I know. That's the way it often happens back there.
Right.
And now, tell us a little bit about the drumming, though, because I was fascinated about that. How did you start with that?
Well, when I was growing up, my brother was a drummer, and I had a good sense of rhythm, but I basically had his rhythms drummed into my head on a daily basis. So we'd walk around the house, and we'd be like, boom, 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 you know, and you'd do everything to the rhythm. You'd make the bed like, do, do, do. And so it was just a natural outcome that I would become a drummer as well. And so when I got old enough, you know, I started playing, and I always wanted to be in a band. And when I went to grad school, I met a few people who were in a band and needed a drummer. And so I just kind of fell into it. And I played out in clubs on the Lower East Side for about 3 years with this band. And that's what the second book is about.
And the band was called?
It was called Stefonic. The singer's name was Stefonic. And we stuck an H in there and made it like Stereophonic. But there was a band already called Stereophonic, so we couldn't use that. So, but it was fun. It was great 3 years, and I lived my dream, you know, and now I'm done with that.
Well, you're a dreamer, and you live your dreams. I was very envious when I read that you were a drummer because, you know, my mom forced the violin on me. In fact, as coming into the studio, we have opera music in the background, and I think of both of our families with that kind of influence in music in general.
Right.
And specifically for me, my mother wanted me to play the violin, which I burnt immediately because I didn't want it. But Marlene Spottheim,
that's the toughest instrument to play.
I know. Yeah, I wanted to play the drums like you, and I would,
aww,
you know.
You still can.
I know. And actually, I still do. I took up the congas
okay.
and the tabla and all that.
Oh, when, there you go. All right. So you're good.
When I could afford to buy them myself.
Right.
But that sense of rhythm, what I really appreciated, we'll get to the book in a minute, but what I appreciate about your writing is the staccato that you put in your writing. It really flows.
Right.
And it's like, okay, here comes the little drum roll. And all right, here's mm-hmm. a percadillo. Here's a percadillo.
Do-da-da-ba-do-ba. Totally. Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. So I want to mention that.
Yeah, I think
that
it definitely comes through.
Yes.
I read stuff out loud when I write it, you know, after I've written it.
Yes.
And I can hear it, you know, I can hear if it's working.
Now, did that come from your radio background too, the talking out loud, or is that just familiar?
No, I did that before. You know, being a writer, I just always read my stuff out loud after I wrote it to see if it sounded right. And you can hear the rhythm better, you know, than if you're reading it in your head. But I never really made the connection until fairly recently that it had something to do with me being a drummer, you know, that sense of rhythm. But it's definitely in there. Yeah.
So your latest book, Murder in Matera, reads like a murder mystery with an unparalleled personal investigative reporting that you do, as well as a travelogue of Southern Italy. I had just received the book to read from your publicist, and my brother wound up sending me. Now, he's still in New Jersey, he sent me an article that was in the NewJersey.com by Mark Iona from the Star Ledger, and he talked about Southern Italian secrets, living simply, living long, and there it was Potenza, and so I had to write to him to tell him about your book, so I have turned on this entire piece of New Jersey to your new book. Because if they like that article, they're going to love this book. You talk about discovering who you are. Could you tell us a little bit about the journey, you know, growing up and then what got you to traveling to Italy to find out?
My first book, you know, Five Finger Discount, was about all the criminals in my family in New Jersey. And, you know, everybody, as soon as you say criminals in New Jersey, they assume it's the mafia, which it was not. It was low level, you know, petty crime. My grandfather was the worst of the bunch. He was a murderer. But everybody else was a bookie. You know, there was a political fixer. There was a mob consigliere. He was the smartest guy in the family. He was a lawyer. But nobody was like a made man in the mafia. So it was all this dabbling, you know, everybody stole from work, you know, it was one of those things. And so, you know, I collected those stories, and one of those stories was about my great-great-grandmother, Vita. And it was really just a couple of paragraphs in Five Finger Discount about her, because I didn't know anything about it. We really just were going on rumors, you know, it was like fumes of stories. And so after that book came out, it was a pretty big hit. And then I wrote the book about, you know, being in the band, because that had just happened in my life, so I wrote that. And then I was like, what do I do next? You know, and I had, that story had always nagged at me, you know, what were the details of that story? Because every other story I could research here in America. I would go to the newspaper archives, you know, I went to the criminal files, and I found all those other family stories. But the stuff about Southern Italy, you couldn't do from here, you know. So I knew I had to go back. So I went back about, I think it was 12 years ago, and a little more maybe 13 now, gosh. Time. Anyway, my daughter was a year old. She is just going to turn 14. So that's how I gauge how long ago it was. And my son was 3.5. And I took my mom with me. She had never been to Italy. She was in her 70s at the time. And we went down to the village that our family is from. And I really didn't know what to expect. I think, you know, I'd seen too many movies of people arriving in their homeland and people coming out and hugging them and, you know, feeding them as soon as they get off the plane. And it was not that. It was really very different. A lot of people wouldn't talk to me. It was a very closed society, very closed culture. It was very poor. And I spent a month there, you know, hitting roadblock after roadblock trying to find this story. And of course, you know, because it was a scandal, nobody wanted to talk to me. I mean, these people have been living with this story there for decades, you know, and they just don't want to discuss it. You know, it's just, it's a different culture than we have here. Everybody talks about everything and it's not a big deal, but there they have to live with it. So I came back pretty much empty handed. I mean, the first third of the book is that trip, you know, with going with my kids. And it was so difficult having little kids there with me while I was trying to do work that I swore I was not going to go back while they were little. I had to wait till they grew up. So I did as much research as I could on the American end, which wasn't that much. I mean, I read every book about Basilicata, which is the region that we're from. And, you know, I did some archival research from this end, but I knew I had to go back, but I had to wait till the kids were big enough. And so when they were 11 and, what was he, 14, I went back. And I found the murder in 3 days. So, and yeah, it was just this incredible 600-page criminal file that I found. And so the second half of the book is just, you know, telling that story, basically, that I found and how I found it. Basically, I kind of take you with me on this ride to Southern Italy with me. As I find something, I then unravel that story that I find or that piece of information. Yeah.
Your persistence and your perseverance, even, you know, in the United States for those 10 years, was that like a big itch with you, though? It's like, oh, I really...
I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and my family's really stubborn, so it kind of came in handy, you know, that Italian, like, stubborn gene, you know, which most of my relatives have. But for me, it manifested itself in the writing, you know, in the research. And, you know, I was trained as a reporter. I worked as a daily newspaper reporter. And I'm one of the reporters who always got the story. So there are certain reporters who come back with excuses and some reporters who always come back with the story. And I always came back with the story. And so it was like this multi-pronged, you know, it was a sense of pride. It was a sense of wanting to know this family story. That's my family story. And also the one thing that was nagging me was, you know, where is this criminal gene coming from? You know, was this coming from my relatives from over a century ago? And I worry about my own kids. You know, I did at the time. I don't worry so much anymore. They're fun. But when they were little, I thought, well, is it going to manifest themselves in them? You know, so I really wanted to dig this up and find out what the source of it was, you know. So that kind of pushed me back to go back.
Well, you talk about the criminal gene, and it wasn't just so much something that you worried about. There's actual, you know, people write papers, et cetera, about this thing. And was that how it got to you, or was just the stories that you heard over and over again, thinking, oh my gosh, now I'm having children?
Yeah, it was originally just the stories, because as I was writing the first book, it became evident how prevalent that criminal gene was in the family, whether it was a gene or whether it was just, you know, a social thing. Yeah, passed down, whatever the hell it was. You know, I was just trying to figure it out. And then as I was researching this book, I stumbled across this new research that's been done in the last 2 years about this violent gene. It's like a violent criminal gene that some people have isolated. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding it, whether it's real and whether, you know, people don't want to talk about it because it can lead to a lot of problems like racism and, you know, things like that. So there's not much out there about it, but I researched as much as I could. I got in touch with the scientist who isolated the gene, and I spoke to him. I think he's from Sweden. And so I did as much research on that front as I could. I don't think it's just crime. I think it's more violent crime, you know.
And we are having discussions about that today in our immigration policies. I'll get to that a little later on.
Exactly.
When did you realize, though, that the topic of your family, which this is the most fascinating thing that you could write about?
That wasn't until I was in graduate school, actually, because I had kind of run away from it. You know, I left to go to Alaska. And then when I came back from Alaska, I went to graduate school. And I was just, you know, going to write about the new things in my life and, you know, whatever came along. And I was just stepping away from that whole scene. You know, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I moved out of New Jersey. And my professors at Columbia, when they would see my stories about my family, because every now and then they would give you an assignment, you know, write about your family, write about your brother, write about your father, they would be like, oh, my God, this material, it's amazing. You've got, you know, narrative gold here. You know, you need to write about this stuff. And for a couple of years, I was just like, no, it's not. I don't want to do that. I have no interest. And I kind of ignored them. And then as I sort of gathered these stories in school, it became clear that there was this trend in my family almost, you know, and the stories were amazing. You know, when you're in class with a bunch of other kids and they're writing about really boring stuff, you've got good stories. You know, the anecdotes were just amazing. And so that's how it was born, sort of. It was just these few little stories that had been assignments at Columbia. And then it grew from there.
Because there had been lots of stories, and children of famous, particularly mob bosses, would write their tales. And it seemed sometimes almost sensationalized. And then it became the norm. And then you had The Sopranos come out, which is even further. You probably thought, well, you know, my story is not as interesting as that story. But when you look back, especially going back to Vida and Vida's life and in Basilicat, as you say.
Yeah, right.
It does become more interesting, and it is a lot of fuel for tales from you, and I just find it fascinating. Maybe it's because I had mentioned before, you know, my Italian background and family is from Bari, so we talk about Southern Italy in the same reference. You know, my people were from the seaport, which is different than Basilicat, but still the poorness of people and why they chose to come over. So that's already in the family. It's like, okay, they were poor, or they, this, that, and the other, the circumstances where they came over during this big rush. But who were they?
Right.
Who were they? I love when you talk about leave the dead in peace. That was one of the first things that you heard when you went to the town.
Right, right. Go back to America and leave the dead in peace.
Right.
I think that was a direct quote. like I said, nobody wanted to talk about it, and it was pretty awful. Life there was really awful, and they didn't want to talk about it. And when they came here, they didn't want to talk about it. And that's why we don't know the whole story. And that's why I think this book is important, particularly for people who are Italian Americans, because they really don't know what happened. They have no idea. I didn't know, and most of the people I've talked to had no idea. I mean, you knew they were poor. You know it was bad. Obviously, they're leaving their home forever. It's going to be bad, right? But I had no idea just how bad. It was a feudal farming system until through the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. And it's insane. Feudalism ended hundreds of years ago in most places. This was still going on in southern Italy. So,
if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm your host, Brenda Starr, and my guest is author Helene Stepinski. And we're discussing her newest book, Murder in Matera, a true story of passion, family, and forgiveness in southern Italy. So let's go back to Southern Italy, where Vito was from. One of the things that you just had mentioned, the part about we don't really understand our ancestors until we either go back and see where they're from or see our face in distant relatives. And the understanding that I got from reading your book about my own grandmother's life coming over as a teenager on the boat with her cousin, you know, going to marry some guy who she didn't love. She loved the butcher back in Italy. It's pretty fascinating. And you're so correct as far as most Southern Italians don't know where they come from. There's a propensity here, I think, for people to say they're from Sicily.
Yeah, or from Naples, too.
I know.
People think they came from Naples, but the boat left from Naples. They didn't come from Naples. They got on the boat in Naples. Hardly anybody came from Naples. It was very unusual for people to leave Naples.
So tell me some stories about you did travel to see where she left from. But let's talk about Southern Italy for a while. It's the most fascinating travelogue. And your mention about, yes, it was a feudal system. People were either dirt poor, malaria was rampant. During that period from 1890 to 1915, 16, there were, a million plus more Southern Italians?
Yeah, I mean, I guess from the late 1800s to 1950, I think it was something like 8 million people came, 8 or 9 million people came. That's insane. That's like a crazy number of people. A lot of places lost at least half their population. You know, Basilicata, which is where my family is from, yeah, it was like a high 40%, like 48% or something like that left. These towns were just emptied out, you know. The people who were left behind were the old people and maybe a couple of kids, you know, all the men left.
And talking about children, you know, you mentioned something that most of us here don't realize, unless there's personal experiences, that a child, if they got to live to be a year, that was a big deal. There was a big birthday for that because infanticide and children dying before the age of 5 was very rampant there.
Yeah, more than half of the kids in southern Italy died before they were 5 years old. So that's just a crazy statistic. And I didn't know anything about that before I went back there. The thing I did know is that in an Italian-American family, you've got a big party for that one-year-old. We did that in my family. My sister did it with her kids. You know, it was always a big deal when the baby turned one. And I always wondered about it because I always thought to myself, well, the kid's not going to remember the party. Why are we having this big party? You know, it was like 100 people and a big rum cake. So when I went back, I found out that all these children died at such a young age that if you did reach the age of one, it was like almost a miracle. So that's where that celebration comes in for that 1 year. You know, it's like you survive, maybe you'll make it. So it's definitely tied to that. And that was fascinating to me. And I didn't know anything about that. So
it's kind of a companion to when you learn about your family, when someone dies. My grandmother lost a 2-year-old. And from that moment on, she was never the same. Now, I heard all her stories, all the scary stories, and the man that comes up the stairs, you know, the myths and this, and all the stuff that every culture has that, you know, someone's going to sit on your chest and all that stuff. And it comes from those fascinating times. But then her fears between there and on the boat, and then when she arrived in this new world, all that got thrown on her children as well. And then when that death happened to her 2-year-old, she really probably went back to those days in Italy and really could never come out of that again.
Yeah. There's something called, I think it's called a testamento. I forget the exact name of it, but there was this kind of syndrome that women would go through when their babies died. They would like go into this comatose state. You know, it was so traumatic for them. And it happened again and again and again. It was like, you couldn't even, it was so emotional and so horrible. You couldn't even process it. And they would go into like this bit of a coma. And then after that, they would come out of it, and then they'd start banging their head against the wall and pulling their hair. And it was this whole process of dealing with your child's death. And you think about it, it's like if you had 6 kids, generally 3 of them died. And that's what happened with Vita. And we had no idea. We just thought she had those 3 kids that she came over with on the ship, which one of them was lost. So that was a whole other story in my family. We didn't know the details of that. But she had all these other kids that we didn't even know about. And so basically women had babies every 2 years. So it was basically based on breastfeeding, you know.
Right.
Breastfeeding serves as a birth control. And when you stop breastfeeding, you get pregnant again. And that's basically what happened with her. She got pregnant every 2 years.
So unraveling all these tales, when you went back the second time, you lived there a month or two by yourself?
Yeah, it was a month again.
You left the kids at home this time, and your mother had something to say about that.
Yeah, she was like, what? You know? do that. I was like, I'm going. You know, you're staying with them and I'm leaving. And my husband obviously helped. He jumped in. He took some time off. But he knew I had to go. I mean, he was one of the people pushing me to go because he knew. He's an editor, and he knew it was a good story. And he's like, you know, over the years, he was like, you got to go back. You got to go back. And I had gone back to write a travel piece, actually. And when I was there, I got the bug again, like the year before I went back for the last time. And I had a feeling it was there. I got to do it. I got to go back again. And so I did, and that's when I found it. But, it was the kids were fine. I mean, they, you know, at that point, they were kind of getting sick of me. You know, an 11-year-old, she's rolling her eyes. My son is kind of independent at that point. So they were fine. You know, it was more me. I was like a nervous wreck that something was going to happen while I was gone. And while I'm there, and this is actually in the book, my pediatrician calls accidentally. She's supposed to be calling my husband, but she calls me instead in the middle of the archives, and the phone rings, and it's my doctor. And I'm like, oh my God, something terrible's happened. You know, and I answer, and she says, so the strep test came back positive. And I'm like, strep test? What strep test? You know, and I'm a crazy person when it comes to strep and stuff like that. I'm always a nervous wreck about it. And so, you know, I was very nervous about leaving them, but it was fine. They were fine.
And in that process of being there, you talk about discovering who you are. How did that manifest for you?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but as I'm researching the murder, I find out that some of my relatives weren't my relatives. Let's just leave it at that. And so this long line of criminals that I thought came from there did not exist. And so it was kind of this overwhelming, oh my God, it was one of those moments where you're like, the ground feels like it's shaking under you. You know, you've had this concept of who you are and what your family is for decades, and then with one document, you find out it's not true. So it was a relief, but it took some adjustment, sort of like the history you thought was your history is not your history. My sister wrote me this long letter after she read the book, and she called me then and was crying, and she's like, you know, you've redeemed Vita, you've redeemed the family. It was very emotional. So, and I think that's probably the case of a lot of people. You know, you think you know your family story. You think you know what happened. But I bet if you go back, you're going to find another story.
I was going to ask you the length of covering this in your head. What was that process like in your head for over 10 years?
Well, it was kind of off and on. You know, it wasn't straight through. I was, you know, freelancing at the time. I was running other stuff and teaching and things like that. I had other things, and the kids, of course, concentrating on them. But it was always there. It was always at the back of my mind, nagging at me. You got to find this story. I had this instinct that it was there and this intuition. You know, we've got a lot of that in my family. But there was another part of me that worried, well, maybe what if it's not there? You know, how long do you look for something without finding it? How much time do you spend? Because there's no card in the card catalog that is going to say to you, stop looking. This isn't here. You can just look and look for years and years. And so finding it was such a relief on so many levels, just personally, but also as a reporter and as a researcher. It was like this big weight. Like I said, it was only 4 days in I found it. And then I had the rest of that month to do all the follow-up research. That's when I found the other kids, the birth certificates, found all the death certificates. Found all kinds of other stuff. So it was pretty mind-blowing.
Well, your tenacity certainly paid off. And
I'm just stubborn. And,
well, yeah, you are. But, you know, in a very good way.
Right.
But it also led you to go to other parts of southern Italy that perhaps you wouldn't have gone to if you hadn't found it right away. It gave you the leisure time to explore more.
Isn't true.
Which I thought was very fascinating, because from there you really develop all the colors, the smells, and the tastes in your book.
Well, the thing about Basilicata is it's very undiscovered. A lot of people don't go down there. And the history is incredible. You know, it goes back, obviously, to Paleolithic times, but the written history and the archaeological history dates back to the Greeks from the 8th century BC. And so there's all these ruins there, and just layer upon layer of invaders, you know, who came through, and it's so thick and so rich, you know. Having that 10 years to explore that was kind of a gift, you know what I mean? I think if I had found the murder the first time around, the book wouldn't have had that. It wouldn't have had that rich. It's like cooking sauce, you know what I mean? The longer
yes.
you cook it, the better it's going to be. And that's how it was, because I went back again and again, and so I just kept discovering these things. And I also became friendly with the people there. You know, they got used to me, and then they started opening up to me more. And I met the town historian, and he was incredible. You know, he just gave me all this background on the place. And then when I got back here, I could do the reading on it. And so I was able to sort of inject that into the book. And it's just layered. So, and that's some of my favorite stuff. And again, people don't know that background. They don't even know they're from Basilicata half the time. They think they're from Naples, like I said. So they don't even know where to look. But Basilicata has this rich history and rich, rich culture. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's very untouched. And I recommend everyone goes there, whether you're from Italy or not. It's beautiful.
And if it wasn't for the fact that people were poor, starving, they would have never left that country. That's what you find out when you go visit there. Immigration to the United States peaked. And in 1890, right before your great-great-grandmother came over, immigrants made up nearly 15% of the population.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
And you write in the book, I want to read, you write, "I had written thousands of stories in my lifetime as a newspaper reporter, magazine writer, and author. But none of those stories compared to Vida's life story. The miseria, the dead babies, the living babies, the murder, the trip to and then from Naples. She hadn't written about others' adventures, but had lived her own, which gave way to ours. She and all those millions of immigrants, your family included, who had come to make their lives and the lives of their children better. The mothers, the grandmothers, the great-grandmothers, and the great-greats were the unsung champions who had cooked and cleaned and washed mountains of laundry and fed and taught and nursed us back to health decade after decade, pushing each generation forward, not out of our self-interest or personal gratification, but out of love. Those are the true heroes," you say, and I want to thank you for putting that in the book, especially at a time like this now. You know, the Italians were the dirty criminals then who were being treated as the Mexicans are treated now in a political perspective. And I think that adds so much to your book, Helene.
Yeah, well, when I was researching the book and writing the book, that wasn't happening. This immigration problem, there was no one saying you can't come in anymore. And no one saying the words on the Statue of Liberty don't mean anything. You know what I mean? It's outrageous to me. And so the book addresses that without addressing it, because I didn't know that it wasn't happening at the time. And so now when you read it, a paragraph like that you just read informs everything that's happening now. And those people are still coming. They're not from Italy anymore. They're from Syria, or they're from Mexico, and they're looked down upon, but they're people who are suffering in the place that they're coming from, and they just want a good life for themselves and mostly for their kids. And I wrote an op-ed piece about it for the Times when the book first came out back in May. And I had so much mail. I mean, it was crazy. Mostly good, a couple of bad letters as well. But it really touched a nerve with people. And my theory was that if you are Italian-American, how can you, in good conscience, stop these other people from coming? Because you have no idea what they went through, your ancestors. Your ancestors were abused big time. You know, they were just branded criminals right from the beginning. So it's kind of sad what's happening, I think.
But the commonality of immigrants and why they choose to come here is something that, well, I would like to toast with you. I would. I would like to toast with you around your new book. We'll toast with a Rob Roy straight up with a cherry, okay?
Awesome.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today, for writing this book, for sharing your experience and doing it in such a beautiful way.
Thank you so much.
All right.
I'm glad you appreciated it.
I sure do. You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with fellow Jersey girl, Helene Stepinski, whose latest book is a memoir entitled Murder in Matera, a true story of passion, family, and forgiveness in Southern Italy, from HarperCollins Publishers. For more information, you can visit Helene Stepinski. That's STAPINSKI.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Katie Whiteside, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this program again, visit our permanent blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU.